Today at Reader's Corner, Nancy Napier, author of Wise Beyond Your Field, How Creative Leaders Out-Innovate to Outperform.
Our goal, really, is to bring this notion of being creative to get better to the community as a whole. By putting people together that don't know the jargon, really don't care about the business. All they care about is being good leaders in their organizations. It's been phenomenal. I'm finding that people want to know how to start their own learning groups like this. And so it's been really interesting to have some of the other members join me, and we're kind of debriefing why some of them work, why some have not. And it's fascinating to see that people want to do this.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. It's not often we bring on a guest to talk about the positive aspects of a gang, but today's guest has assembled a gang that is far from ordinary. Several years ago, Boise State University professor Nancy Napier pulled together leaders from key Boise-based organizations that were experiencing measurable success and convinced them they had a good deal they could share and learn from one another. That put Bronco head football coach Chris Peterson in the same room with Ada County Sheriff Gary Rainey, software developer Bob Locken, dancer John Michael Shirt, and several others, including Dr. Napier. They have become quite a team, and collectively they have written a book, Wise Beyond Your Field, How Creative Leaders Out-Innovate to Outperform. Dr. Napier is founder and director of the Center for Creativity and Innovation here at Boise State. She is a regular blogger for Psychology Today and the author of several other books, including Insight, Encouraging Aha Moments for Organizational Success, The Creative Discipline, Mastering the Art and Science of Innovation, and Managing Relationships in Transition Economies. Dr. Napier received the Boise State University Foundation Research Award last year, as well as Vietnam's Medal of Honor for her contributions to education there. She is the first recipient of both the Ada Burke Research Fellowship and the John Aloriaga Fellowship. Nancy joins us today in the studio for this interview. Nancy Napier, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So how did this all get started? What was the very beginning of this little enterprise that's now become so well known in the Valley?
As you know, Boise State had a very large project in Vietnam for a long time, for 9 years. And when I was finished with that, I thought, I really need to find some research that I don't have to travel 36 hours to get to. And I looked around town and stumbled on, as good ideas often happen, Charlie Fee from the Idaho Shakespeare Festival, director, and Bob Locken, who's the CEO of a software company, and began getting interested in organizational creativity. There's a lot that's been done in individuals, but not so much in organizations. And so one summer, I thought, well, let me find out how they operate. Got started with those two, stumbled onto the football program. This was back in Dan Hawkins' day, even. And then started giving some talks around town about what I was seeing that they had in common. So you'd think of organizations like that as having nothing in common. But as far as they approached being creative, they actually did. And I gave talks and then would ask about other organizations in town that were high-performing and highly creative. The name HealthWise came up 3 times. So I added them. Wrote a book about that, the first one on the creative discipline. And after that, then, during that process, I would go from the football program to software to theater and back to football. And our coach, Chris Peterson, one day said, you know, you get to learn from all these people. Can we all get together? And I thought, well, of course, why not? So we had our first annual gang meeting, and I told the 4 organization leaders they could each bring 4 to 6 people, and Peterson said, can I bring all my coaches? I said, of course, bring them all. So we had actors next to engineers next to coaches, and that's the way it really got started as a group, a larger group. And then I added other organizations as I did another project, another research project.
Now, Coach Peterson didn't exactly think he was the chemistry for innovation and creativity, did he? Which sounds kind of bizarre to the rest of us who have watched him coach. But
Exactly. I went over there to talk with Dan Hawkins. I had a student who was a football player, and he said, of course there's creativity in football. I kept hearing ESPN people say this. It's risky. It's creative. Dan Hawkins was all over it. He said, sure, come talk to our coaches. First time I talked to Chris Peterson, you know him well. He's an incredibly gracious man. And he said, I'm not creative. Football's all about routine and structure. And I said, can I just stay and ask you a few more questions, though? Of course. And so he kept telling me how they recruit differently from other programs, how they coach differently, how they train differently, how they develop people differently. And I came away thinking, you may not think you're creative, but of course you are. So we have the gang annual meeting. A year or so goes by, and he says, creativity, too artsy. Can I say we're innovative? I get it that we do things differently. And I said, of course, use whatever word you want. And then another year later, in the newspaper, there was a quote from him after a bowl game win. He said, we love creativity. It's just who we are. So now we've called him out in public about it, and he uses the word all the time, of course. And he is. He knows it now.
Absolutely. Well, do you think this gang is going to go on ad infinitum? I mean, is there a termination to the gang as a group, or does it just keep on moving?
You know, I'm very selfish. I've used the gang as my research sites, as high-performing, highly creative organizations. And so I continue to do some research, but I can't imagine it will go on forever. One of the members, the key members leader, John Michael Sherritt, who's been at Trey McIntyre Project for a long time, is leaving. He may be in Boise. I don't know yet what will happen there. So we're in the process of thinking about what does a group like that do when it faces transition. There's no guarantee those leaders will stay in place forever either. So I suspect it won't live forever, but I'm hoping for another little while. We've got a couple more book ideas we can put out, and it's been really fun for them to learn from each other and for me to tap them.
Well, you've also sparked an interest in the community way beyond this little group that gathers as the gang. So now you've put together some mini gangs, and I might add, I love your choice of titles, the Posse, the Hard Rock Miners, the Wranglers, and the Sidewinders. What are all these little groups now?
Well, so many people asked about joining the gang, and I said, that one's pretty well set. So we began starting other gangs. We actually have started more than one. These other four, we started one that failed. So in each of this starting up new ones, we've learned something new. The point of these really has been to bring together people from different sectors, wildly different sectors, who are aggressive learners, who have high output and low ego, really want to learn, and who are good at asking questions and absorbing information. They're not defensive about what they do. So as people have approached me over the years, then I'll say, okay, let's watch and see who else may come up. So we've been very deliberate. I have a colleague, and we've been very deliberate about putting together the sectors and the personalities. So we vet everyone to make sure that they will be good learners, aggressive learners, that their personalities will fit, that they don't know each other. And that's important because we find, like the original gang, or me talking to football or the sheriff, they have to speak English to each other. And so by putting people together that don't know the jargon, really don't care about the business, all they care about is being good leaders in their organizations, it's been phenomenal. I'm finding that people want to know how to start their own learning groups like this. And so it's been really interesting to have some of the other members join me, and we're kind of debriefing why some of them work, why some have not. And it's fascinating to see that people want to do this. Now, the other interesting thing, and an experiment, is that I gave a talk in Australia last November at a university, but then also to about 60 business people. And out of that, there's a couple of people that want to form the Odd Dot Gang, they call it. Same thing is happening in Houston, Texas. So we'll see if some of these remote sites, if they can do it on their own, or if it really depends on making sure that you vet them right, that you've got a facilitator that wants this to happen. Maybe you have somebody who wants to learn as a researcher, and how that'll work. But the notion of aggressive learner gangs just makes so much sense these days.
Now, your first gang, with the exception of its leader, that would be Nancy Napier.
I'm the facilitator.
Well, okay. But they were all men.
They are all
men. And so what about all these other gangs? Did you find a way to bring women into the fold?
Yes, we brought in women because that struck me that, all these guys are guys and they're good. So the other ones do have a mix. So, for example, in the Hard Rock Miners, we have superintendent of schools from Idaho City. And so since that was a mining town, that's where the name came from.
Perfect.
Jessica Flynn, who you may know, who's the CEO of Red Sky. Kate Pape, who's head of health services at the Ada County Sheriff's Office and so forth. Dale Pike is actually in one of those from the University of the Technology Head. So we have this mix, again, of industries. We've got a lawyer in that one. And women and all the rest of them, yes, to be sure.
You know, when I hear you define the work and the potential of the mini gangs, it reminds me of an earlier project of yours, if you want to call it a project. You were very supportive of the work of Richard Florida, the fellow who wrote about the creative city in two or three different books that he's written. This sure sounds like a spinoff of that, to the extent that you use these mini gangs to go out into the community. really shake things up and change things around and really continue the tradition of creativity and innovation that I guess one could argue started with whatever J.R. Simplot was drinking in the morning. And I do mean water or something like that.
Yeah, right. No, I think you're right. And that's a really good point. When you first came to Boise, all of that was just getting started. And so the impact, what I've learned about all this, is to have some people with a true big voice in town help convey that message. So when you and I first started talking about it, and you talked about it in the community, with Chris Peterson, to have a football coach talk about creativity, to have a sheriff talk about it, that has made other people in the community sort of sit up and say, well, what's this all about? How do I do things differently to get better? Which is simply what it is. And so our goal, really, as we, the gang, has talked about it, is to bring this notion of being creative to get better to the community as a whole. I remember an early meeting, annual meeting, with the gang members, and I said, this is really your group, you all. Is there a project that you'd like to do together? They're all busy. And they said, probably can't do something together, but we're all interested in economic development. And so, as they said, a coach cannot recruit a student to a university unless there's a job afterwards, unless it's a safe community. A software company can't bring anybody in unless there's a learning opportunity at the university, unless there are cultural activities, unless there's sports. So they began to see that their common goal, even though they're going about it in different ways, was economic development for the community. So that was a major aha moment for me to think, they are doing that even though they're not doing a joint project that we can point to. They're really learning about how to improve their organizations. But as you say, it's almost like a spider plant. They go out and they talk about being members of gangs and what they're learning and gaining, and it does spread throughout the community. So it's been fascinating. We want to find a way to leverage this and move it throughout the state if possible, but then beyond.
You're listening to Nancy Napier, author of Wise Beyond Your Field, How Creative Leaders Out-Innovate to Outperform. You know, as I read your book and I thought about this idea that you're emphasizing in the book about the commonality that exists in leadership and management, no matter what the field, and therefore the title of your book, Wise Beyond Your Field, I couldn't help but wonder if you took this to the nth degree, what would it be like if you took all these guys and scrambled them and for 1 week or 1 month said, Chris Peterson, you're running ProClarity, or White Cloud Analytics, as it's called today, or not it's called, but Bob's new business. And we're going to take HealthWise, and we're going to yank somebody over from some other. And you wonder what would happen if you did that.
That would be fascinating, wouldn't it?
I mean, first of all, I think in many ways the skills of leadership are the same no matter where you are. But then when you get down, let's just talk about Chris Peterson for the moment. I don't think too many of us understand the X's and the O's the way he does. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, mm-hmm, I think there's a lot of commonality.
That's really interesting. One of the other groups called the Wranglers has another one of your favorite coaches in it, Leon Rice.
Oh, sure.
Basketball. Yeah, right. And he came to speak to a class of mine recently, and he said, you all may think I'm the X and O guy, but really, as the leader of an organization, what I do is crisis management. I'm solving problems all the time. And that's something that Peterson said a few years ago. He said, when I finally realized that the problems weren't getting in the way of my job, the problems are my job. So I think as a leader at that level, I'm sure you've experienced that, it's really solving crises, problems, and dealing with people. And so it may not be the technical part as much as it was before, because you've got to think much more broadly, much more broadly.
And you have all those position coaches to do all of the X's and the
Yes,
O's.
That's right. Within organizations, too, you have the same thing,
don't you?
Yeah, we call them department directors, deans, whatever, yeah. Well, you mentioned the aha moment. That clearly, it's almost your signature. I mean, I think Nancy Napier deserves credit for whatever we all think of that aha moment, and you've written a book about it. Tell us a little bit about just what that is, and I guess most importantly, how do you make those moments happen in an organization? And that's something that's, of course, in your
book.
Yeah,
and that's another one I blame our poor dear coach for, Chris Peterson. I think I was giving the program football coaches a review on the previous book of what was coming out and wanted to get their reaction. And at one point, Peterson said, you know, we get students for 4 or 5 years here, and it takes some of them 2 to 2.5 years to really get it, why they're here, not just the football part, but everything else. And I thought, that's an aha moment, is really a sudden understanding or solution of a problem. Is it possible to speed that up? That's the basic question. And in fact, it is. There's all kinds of research out there, neurobiology and so forth, that you can't. And so I break it down into three chunks of things that have to happen. When you're trying to learn something new or solve a problem, you're absorbing or going after lots of information. It's like standing in front of a fire hydrant. You get it, and it doesn't make sense to you. You eventually start sorting it out, chunking it, right? And at that point, the pieces may come together. But if not, then you go through what I call a spark phase. And that's where you can use techniques to help you do some of this. So some of these things like connecting odd dots or looking at the problem from reverse, totally upside down than what you might think. And typically, something will happen then. One of the things I found interesting is people who have done this for a long time say they don't really have aha moments after a while. And I said, whoa, what's happened? Well, Gary Rainey, Chris Peterson, Bob Locken would say, I automatically look at something from a different angle. I automatically think about what piece from another field could I use. So they do this almost as a routine. So they spark an aha moment. Often they need to take a break. I stand in the shower. It happens all the time. And then you have to check it. You've got to make sure that it's really valid. And you might check it with experts. But as Einstein has said, a colleague of his attributes this to him, if you can explain it to a barmaid, then it makes sense. So I find that, again, these gang leaders are very good about saying, all right, I've got this idea. Now, before I go and run with it, I need to check it out. So it's sorting information, sparking the aha, and then checking it to make sure that it really works. And those are things you can learn to do.
So in your book and in your research, you are really documenting what these individuals do in their lives when it comes to inspiring, when it comes to motivating, when it comes to getting results. I guess the question becomes, how much of this is teachable or learnable, let's say? How much of this is intuition that, thank goodness we have these guys in the gang, but to stand them up before a class and expect them to teach this in the way that it's going to sink in for every last student, we're not all made that way.
I hate to tell you what my next project is.
Okay, all right.
That's exactly what it is. You're way ahead of me. So that's the next question, of course. And so how do you take particularly these intangible things, turn them into behaviors or actions, communicate them to people so they learn them, so that you get the same behavior back? That's the next project. And so in going to talk to a Chris Peterson, a Bob Locken, they say, well, I talk about these things all the time. I model the behavior. And I'm saying, particularly for students, they may not get the modeling. It's too subtle. They may not want to be talked at. So that's what's happening now. I'm starting to learn about how they are thinking about and how they do things they don't realize they're doing, which is to break down certain skills in very granular ways, they say, and then how they communicate it. And what I'm learning, and this is very, very beginning, just did a few interviews, is that they communicate and teach in multiple ways. So they use what I call hear it, see it, do it, and then teach it. So they talk to people, to students about it. If they're lucky, they've got film or something they can show, football. And then they have them experience or do it. And then they have them teach it. And I'm finding in one of the other gang organizations, just getting started, they actually use a similar kind of process. So they're talking, they're trying to show things visually, they're having people experience making good decisions, collaborating, and they're having them teach one another. I guess the surprise to me so far, and I'm not going to say this is really true, is that it takes a lot more practice than I think we realized. So for you to teach me, to tell me something in a class and expect me to remember that next semester, no wonder that doesn't happen. We're all upset when students walk in and say, well, I didn't have supply and demand curves last semester. Well, that's because they didn't hear it, they didn't do it or use it repeatedly. So that, I think, I'm fascinated now to begin to find out how this may be working in a sports setting. That's one thing, in a dance setting, but in a head setting. So where it's engineers or at the jail, how do they actually convey these ideas so that people, you may throw it to me, you may try to communicate to me. I have to be willing and able to catch it and learn it and use it. That's the other piece of it. So I'm just getting started. So thank you very much
for picking up
a new project
Great.
For me.
Think big. One of the points you make in the book is how all of these guys basically come from relatively small organizations, and yet they manage to jump way out of their league and into the big leagues. I think you mentioned ProClarity that was acknowledged clearly way out of its field when it comes to size. Talk to us a little bit about all of them, just to collectively as a group of small organizations, and how they managed to achieve these distinctions, given the fact that they didn't have going for them the advantage of size that so many have.
They would say that's the advantage. Because they are in a remote setting, they're smaller, they can be underneath the radar screen of an awful lot of organizations or competitors for a long time. So that's one very strong thing that they all recognize could be an advantage. Of course, now as they become better known, it's a little bit harder. I think the other thing we have to remember, our football program did not become a success with the Fiesta Bowl. That started 10 years before. So it's the process of building, building, building. And then what they have said is they begin to talk about, we could achieve this, and people in the organization may say, oh, we couldn't possibly. We can achieve this. And as they start to achieve successes, then it begins to almost roll, and people realize that maybe we can do it, and then they do it. So success breeds success, to be sure. And I think these leaders have been, what's fascinated me about them is that they have really gone out in their own fields and talked about things beyond the X's and O's, beyond the specific jailing, or beyond the software. But they're bigger in their thinking. And as they've gotten on the national stage and some of them international stage, they can talk in a big way that then inspires the people who work with them and the community. Isn't that the wonderful part about all these, is that we are inspired as a community by watching these smaller organizations become maybe not big in size, but big in noticeability and visibility.
Right. Brings up for me the whole issue of scale. Because if you flip this argument, as the president of an organization that has 22,000 students and 650 full-time faculty or whatever the number is, 2,400 employees overall, trying to get a hold of it and squeeze productivity out of it is a lot more difficult than the little bitty school I attended as an undergraduate, 700 students, mm-hmm. a handful of faculty. And when the dean or the president said, you shall do this, everybody marched in line. And so I guess that one of the great advantages of these organizations is that they don't have to deal with the problem of scale when it comes to the issue of productivity.
So let me turn the tables around. What have you seen is what's the trigger size, and when did it start getting really difficult to make that productive?
Well, I don't know whether I have in my 10 years here the perspective to answer that, because it was pretty big when I got here. In other places, I'd say that when you're probably 10,000 students and with the relative number of faculty that would require, the departments are more manageable, the colleges are more manageable, and as you progress, people keep asking us, how big is Boise State going to get? Well, I've never had a good answer for that, but I think we better come up with some kind of an answer that addresses this issue of scale. Mm-hmm. But you see, this is my interview of you and not your interview of me, so we get to move on.
But it also raises a point you've brought up before, which is, how do you encourage creativity in a larger organization?
That's right.
And
exactly.
I think that's a key piece of this, because the larger organizations around town are having problems of encouraging it. So what I've begun to see in some of the bigger ones is pockets of creativity or innovation, where people are frustrated because they want to be doing things but can't. And so I don't know enough about large ones of how you can really make that happen in a very big one. We have a good student who's working for Google now in Ireland, and she's told me a little bit about what they try to do. They keep the units very small. So unit by unit, it feels like one of these size organizations.
Right. Probably one of the best examples of that here is HP. And I don't mean HP here, but HP down in California. They have gone through three or four CEOs since I've been in Boise, and each of them was trying to get a hold of the organization. And the organization's culture was so incredibly strong, I'm not so sure any of them have figured it out yet. And I guess that's an interesting lesson that perhaps you could learn from your guys is, okay, what would you do if your organization was five times the size, and how effective would it be? Steve Appleton's no longer with us. Mark Durkin is now the CEO. It would be interesting to know out at Micron, to your point, where are the pockets of creativity and innovation, and how do they view themselves compared to the way your folks view? Maybe that's your next gang, a big gang.
A big gang. And, you know, that's a great idea. I've had some of the larger CEO companies in town ask about being part of a gang. And I'm not sure how to organize that one, because they all know each other very well. And I don't know yet. But what I fear for those big organizations is that if they're unable to spread this notion of creativity broadly, I'm hearing about stealth pockets happening. So somebody, two or three people in one area, will identify people elsewhere, and they're getting together trying to do things. And right. So if that begins to happen, that's good in a way, but it's not good if it doesn't spread throughout the organization. Mm-hmm. And I think what these guys have been able to do, because they're small, is push it from the top mm-hmm. down. But can it happen in the reverse?
Yeah.
I don't know.
You're listening to Nancy Napier. She is a business professor at Boise State University and the author of Wise Beyond Your Field, which is a book based on her creation of The Gang. You know, the Chamber of Commerce has a series, if it's still going on, called the CEO series, I think, where they bring the CEOs in just to talk at lunch about what they do. But the ones I've been to, they end up talking more about their business than about what it's like to be a leader. Mm-hmm. And if there was some way to focus those guys on, okay, forget your business. I don't want to know what you make. I want to know how you do it. I want to know how you manage to gain productivity day to day to day with, you know, 2,000 employees or way more, 8 or 9,000 employees mm-hmm. in Micron's case. Making the unimagined real, that was another one of the lessons that came out of The Gang. Help us understand that one.
Well, one example of that one to me was Charlie Fee, who runs the Idaho Shakespeare Festival, also manages another theater in Cleveland. And he wanted to help the people in Cleveland understand the experience of an outdoor theater. And he wanted to recreate that at an indoor theater. And they couldn't imagine it. And so he started very slowly by pushing the board to allow people to bring a glass of wine into the theater after intermission. Very small steps like that so they could begin to see what's possible. He gave those talks in front of the curtain. Well, that was heresy back in Ohio. So slowly he would do these things that shook people up but made them realize that it was possible, it was good. Finally, he started bringing board members out to Idaho. They could see how it works outside. And then they could go back and he said, now let's think about what a theater, an indoor theater, would look like that would have the same kind of experience. He was actually the trigger for a lot of this. I blame Peterson and Fee because he introduced me to that Richard Florida book. And that book, as you recall, is a lot about experience. People don't want things as much as a really nice experience. The other piece I'm learning is you have to start small with some people. You can't just say, we could win this championship or we could be this kind of a company sold off to Microsoft. The small steps, and then people can begin to see it. So you have the vision for Boise State University, but the rest of us have to come at it a little
right.
bit more slowly.
I was told by a friend one time when I was assuming my first university presidency, remember, Bob, change is great. But the best change is that which goes undetected.
Oh, that's good.
And, you know, to some extent, especially when you're dealing with faculty, as you know, they like to go slowly along. And when you try to do it radically, it's not going to work.
Uh-huh.
I have one question here that may be our last. We'll see how our time is going here. But I was so fascinated by the lesson of avoid idea central.
So the idea there is if an organization depends too much on the leader or on a single person or a couple of people to generate the new ideas to where to go, that's very dangerous for a lot of reasons. One is Bob Kustra could be run over by a bus.
Right.
Second is Bob Kustra, if everyone says, oh, those are great ideas, Bob, you come up with them, I relinquish the responsibility of coming up with ideas. So you're taking it on
off
and you're
hook.
letting me off the hook. And finally, I think the danger is if we reward you all the time, you think, well, my ideas are the best ideas. And that can be dangerous as well, right? So to get more input from all through the organization is key.
Exactly. Well, the good news is the book is out and people can pick up a copy. It's called Wise Beyond Your Field, Nancy Napier and the Gang. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. It was good fun.
Next week, Jeffrey Wasserstrom, author of China in the 21st Century, What Everyone Needs to Know. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.